You're listening ad-free on Wondery Plus. I have a confession. I have not seen a single episode of Bridgerton. It's wildly popular, well-received by critics, but historically accurate? Probably not. That's not a fault, though. Most of history was horribly dreary and depressing, not great fodder for a TV show. I don't blame anyone for making a good story that's merely inspired by history. But why is Bridgerton, presumably, again, I haven't seen it, a good story? Or a Jane Austen novel, for that matter, which I have read? They're romance stories, of course, but we have plenty of those. What makes these special? It could be the particular setting of the Regency era of British history, when courtship was equal parts business and pleasure. There were rules to follow, rules to break, fortunes to be made and reputations to be lost. It was a high-wire act of desire and sacrifice, saving face and calculated chase. On today's Saturday matinee, we're bringing you an episode from the podcast History Tea Time, in which host Lindsay Holiday investigates debutante balls, the London social season, the upper-class marriage market, and the young women at the center of it all. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow History Tea Time. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
Hello and welcome to History Tea Time. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history.
Royalty 101, Debutantes and the Social Season. From Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters to Downton Abbey and Bridgerton, young debutantes dressed in white gowns with feathers in their hair curtsy before the queen, and then get down to the serious business of attending balls and bagging a rich husband. Debutante balls and the London season have been highly romanticized. But who were these young women? What was the etiquette of court presentation and the social season? What was the upper-class marriage market really like? How did it all come to be, and is it still going on today? Don your finest court gown or your tailcoat and knee breeches, and let's find out. In England in the Middle Ages, the daughters of the aristocracy had no choice about who they married. That decision was made by their fathers. The bride's family paid a dowry to the groom, who would be expected to provide for his wife financially for the rest of her life. Women were barred from inheriting property, and the idea of them working to support themselves was completely unfathomable. Women who were not handed over to a husband were doomed to a life of destitution and begging their brothers for bed and board. Young men were often killed in battle, which meant that in each generation there were usually more unmarried girls than men. Aristocratic parents were eager to find their daughters a suitable husband as early as possible, before all the good ones were taken. Girls were allowed to marry as young as 12. In the late 1400s, King Edward IV took a trip to the royal court of Burgundy, where he took note of the structure of the young men and women at court and their chaste interactions in the guise of courtly love. Edward returned home and restructured his own court in a similar fashion. He invited noblemen to send their wives to serve his queen, Elizabeth Woodville, as ladies-in-waiting, and their daughters as maids of honor. This system served as a finishing school for aristocratic girls and provided them with a chance to be seen by and even interact with eligible young men. Mothers were eager to show off their daughters to potential grooms, and places as maids of honor were incredibly competitive. For those young women who were not able to win a husband, there was one alternative to a life of poverty. She could become a nun. Usually the dowry saved for a husband would instead be donated to a convent. There, women had some modicum of freedom within the confines of a religious life. But all that changed in the early 1500s, when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church in order to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. the king made himself head of the new Protestant Church of England, and Protestants did not abide religious orders. Henry commanded the ransacking of monasteries and convents and stole their wealth to give to his friends. Thousands of monks and nuns were thrown out and given small pensions with which to make their way in the world. Suddenly, young women had only one option for their futures: marriage. And the competition to get a coveted spot at court became even more fierce. Henry's daughter, Elizabeth I, expanded the ranks of maids of honor. She had 60 to 100 young women in her household. Most were 16 or older, but a few were as young as 9. The queen required her maids of honor to gain her permission before marrying. Those who served the queen were permitted to use the title, the Honorable, for the rest of their lives. During the Stuart dynasty, the nobility and the royal family were often at odds, especially when Parliament cut off King Charles I's head. The number of maids of honor dwindled to 8 for queens regnant and only 4 for queens consort. The badly behaved Hanoverian kings and princes made the monarchy a laughingstock. Morally upright, King George III and his German wife, Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, needed to rehab the family's reputation before they too were parted with their heads. So they decided to make philanthropy the new public face of the monarchy. They started throwing charity balls and invited the nobility to see how good they now were. Queen Charlotte's birthday ball on May 19, 1780, was used as a fundraiser for Chelsea Hospital. The royals also invited all of the unmarried noble ladies to be presented to Her Majesty in her drawing room at St. James's Palace. This was the first royal presentation of debutantes, a French word meaning female beginner. From then on, Queen Charlotte's ball was the launch of the social season and of a young woman's life as an adult and hunt for a husband. The nobility, eager to have more and better opportunities to show off their daughters and ensure that they married only the best gentlemen, took to the practice with gusto. Only the daughters of peers of the realm or of aristocratic younger sons in one of the few gentleman professions were allowed to participate. Merchants, though becoming increasingly wealthy, saw their daughters excluded. Young women had to be sponsored by another woman who had already been a debutante. This would usually be her mother or a female relative. On the day of the ball, young women lined up and waited their turn to be announced. When they were up, they had a brief chat with the royals before the young lady put one ankle behind the other and curtsied to Her Majesty and her giant birthday cake. Then she would walk out of the room backwards so that she did not turn her back on the royals, being careful not to trip on her long train. Girls practiced for hours to make sure that they got it right when the eyes of all the court and potential husbands and in-laws were on them. A serious slip-up could spell spinsterhood. No pressure. Queen Charlotte got very involved in the intrigues of the season. She would write in the court circular about girls she was particularly impressed or unimpressed with. A word from Her Majesty could set a debutante up for success or failure. Girls were presented in the finest court dress their families could afford. In the late 1700s, that meant wide mantua hoop skirts, undergowns made of exquisitely dyed and embroidered silk of various colors. A train affixed to the back fell to the floor. The hair was styled in an elaborate updo, held in place with diamond pins and decorated with white ostrich feathers. Two streamers of lace called lappets hung from the back of the head. A decorative fan was appropriate, and jewelry of pearl or silver was allowed, but not gold. By 1804, the Empire silhouette of a high waist and a slim column of skirt traveled from France and took over the London fashion scene. But Queen Charlotte refused to give up the hooped skirts of her youth and required young ladies to wear them to court. This led to some rather odd fashion mashups. Queen Charlotte died in 1818, and only then did her son, King George IV, allow debutantes to leave hooped skirts behind and curtsy in more fashionable gowns. They were still required to wear a train and ostrich feathers, though the lappets were replaced with a veil. After the flurry of the court presentation, the real work began, the social season. Each year from January to July, Parliament met in London. Every man with a title was entitled to a seat in the House of Lords. So aristocratic families left their country estates and flocked to their London mansions and townhouses in the chic West End neighborhoods of Mayfair and Belgravia. Horse races, sporting events, art shows, and festivals were highlights of the season. But the most crucial, frenzied period for the aristocratic marriage market launched with Queen Charlotte's ball in early May and continued through the summer until everyone went back to the country for hunting season at the end of August. English upper-class society was known as the ton, from the French le bel ton, meaning the good tone or those with the proper manners. Members of the ton were intensely etiquette and class conscious, and the social hierarchy was rigid. A single faux pas could affect a girl's social and marriage prospects. Girls were expected to secure a proposal in their first or second season. Otherwise, she would be considered put on the shelf and face a life of spinsterhood and poverty. Young women doing the season felt immense pressure to pack their schedules with as many social events as they could in order to meet and impress the best possible husband. A young lady, along with her mother or chaperone, would spend the morning making social calls on friends and acquaintances. It was important to make social connections not just with potential grooms, but also with other women. They would drink tea and chat in the drawing room, or if no one was home, they would leave a calling card and expect a return visit. In the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen would promenade in the park. During the Regency period, St. James Park was the place to see and be seen. But by the Victorian era, the ton had moved on to Hyde Park. Evening events were the most important, and debutantes kept their schedules packed 7 nights a week, ignoring criticism from the more religious for going out on Sundays. The very wealthiest families hosted private balls with exclusive guest lists. But the cost of these events was staggering. There was a desire for even more events at which young people could mingle. Therefore, public assemblies sprung up to host weekly dances. For some of these, all that was required for entry was the price of a ticket. This is how many social climbing members of the middle class met spouses. But for Almack's, entrance was extremely exclusive. Almack's was run by 7 wives of the wealthiest noblemen in the country. They hosted balls every Wednesday as Parliament was off those nights, and they wanted to make sure that the top members of the House of Lords would be in attendance. These patronesses were hugely influential, cliquey, and vicious. They tightly controlled the guest list and dress code and would blacklist guests who caused offense. They once turned away the Duke of Wellington for wearing trousers instead of knee breeches. If you were deemed worthy, you would be invited to purchase a voucher for the season. Voucher holders could bring 1 guest, but only if they presented themselves to the patronesses beforehand and passed muster. Getting into Almack's was actually considered more important than being presented at court. One poet wrote this bit of advice: "If once to Almack's you belong, like monarchs you can do no wrong. But banished thence on Wednesday night, by Jove you can do nothing right." At balls and masquerades, ladies would be given a dance card at the door listing that evening's program. If a gentleman asked for a dance, they would pencil their name on her card. Ladies did not ask gentlemen to dance. A single dance lasted several minutes and would give the couple a chance to talk and get to know one another. One dance per gentleman was the standard. Two dances might be permitted if a courtship was getting serious, but three would be scandalous unless an engagement was pending. On evenings when ladies didn't have an invitation to a ball, they would attend the theater, the opera, or the pleasure gardens. The audience very rarely paid attention to performances happening on stage, as they were too busy talking and flirting. Having a box at the opera was a show of status. The wealthiest families leased the same boxes for generations, while others might fork up the money to rent or share one for a daughter's first season. Pleasure gardens such as Vauxhall and Renelagh were something like a sculpture garden mixed with an amusement park. Along the beautiful walks lined with trees, topiaries, and flowers, one might see musical or theatrical performances, a hot air balloon, an art installation, or any number of other 18th century entertainments. Young men and women were allowed to talk and get to know each other, only under the watchful eye of a chaperone, and in full view of the public. If a gentleman met a lady he wanted to pursue, he could send her flowers and call on her at her family home during acceptable visiting hours. If they were getting serious, they might promenade together in the park or take a ride in an open carriage. Unmarried men and women would never be alone together, as this could ruin the woman's chance of marrying. If a gentleman wished to propose to a lady, he would first meet with her father. The men would hash out the financial details, the prospective groom offering proof of his ability to provide for a wife, and the father disclosing the size of her dowry. When the men came to an agreement, the young man would make a formal offer of marriage to the young lady. This might be in person, the only time the couple would briefly be left alone together, or in a formal letter. She could refuse, but this would cast a shadow upon her and possibly end her chances of marrying anyone else. If accepted, the gentleman might give his fiancée a ring of gold, gemstone, or enamel. Diamonds did not become popular until the 1900s. All the balls, tickets to events, and buying the latest fashions added up, thus ensuring that only the wealthiest of young people could participate in the season. In addition to being judged on their bankroll, beauty, and breeding, debutantes had to impress potential grooms with their social graces, conversation, proficiency in playing an instrument, and singing, dancing, drawing, speaking foreign languages, and of course, modesty. Girls were trained throughout their childhoods to be seen as ideal wife material. But it wasn't just the women who were being judged. Mamas wanted to get the best son-in-law they could, and that meant a man who held or stood to inherit the highest title possible. At the top were dukes, a rare prize with only about 24 in the nation at any time. Next came marquises, earls, viscounts, and finally barons. Famed poet Lord Byron inherited a barony at the age of 10. He attended London season events and called it a marriage mart. He courted debutante Anne Milbank, and they wed in 1815. But they were mismatched. She was religiously upright and he a notorious philanderer. They had one child and separated a year later. Noble titles, estates, and the bulk of wealth was inherited by the eldest son. Therefore, the size of the nobility remained consistent over the centuries. There were only about 200 noble families in England, and 100 more without a title but with at least 10,000 acres of land. With such a small gene pool, there was a lot of incest going on. Younger sons did not inherit much wealth, so they needed to take up an honorable profession. The limited options included doctor, lawyer, or officer in the military. These men were acceptable grooms for a debutante, but a man with a title was always more desirable. Girls were usually presented at court and put on the marriage market between the ages of 16 and 19. Meanwhile, upper-class young men spend several years attending university, traveling, and possibly learning a profession. They began to look for a bride in their mid-20s to early 30s. Young women were expected to be completely chaste before marriage. Many doctors believed that women had no sexual desire whatsoever. Their mamas might give them a basic explanation of the birds and the bees before their wedding night, or they might be told to simply do as their husband instructed. Meanwhile, it was considered a rite of passage for a young man to make his first trip to a brothel. Men usually went into marriage with a great deal of sexual experience with lower-class women. They may even have a venereal disease or an illegitimate child or two. When she was 17, beautiful, stylish Georgiana Spencer bagged society's most eligible bachelor, William Cavendish, the Duke of Devonshire. Though she and her parents were thrilled with the match, the marriage was far less joyous. William had more interest in drinking, gambling, and womanizing than his young bride. He was furious that it took her 16 years to provide him with a male heir and instructed her to raise his illegitimate daughter. William took Georgiana's best friend as a mistress, and the couple lived separate lives. In 1837, 18-year-old Queen Victoria came to the throne. She was a romantic and took a great interest in debutante presentations. A statement was issued that debutantes must be sure to wear feathers large enough for the Queen to see. The event was moved to the newly constructed Buckingham Palace. Victoria wore white to her own wedding in 1840, and she made the color standard for brides. As presentations are all about a girl's eligibility to be a bride, white soon became the de rigueur shade for debutantes as well. Debutante gowns continued to follow the silhouette of the day, in white with the addition of a train, veil, ostrich feathers, and a feather fan or bouquet of myrtle in the hand. Victoria acted as the fairy godmother of the debutantes, suggesting advantageous marriages for the ones who particularly impressed her. By the mid-1800s, Almack's had lost its sparkle. A German prince complained that the rooms were plain and the refreshments wretched, and despite his own difficulty in securing a ticket, a great many nobodies had wriggled in. The operation was finally shuttered in 1863. In the late 1800s, many British noble families were financially exhausted. They could no longer ignore the incredible wealth of businessmen. Meanwhile, the daughters of American industrialists, who were allowed to inherit wealth, wanted to legitimize their recent success with an ancient noble title. A number of American heiresses traveled to London to participate in the season, and some of them bought their way into a court presentation. Former debutantes were paid astronomical fees to sponsor young ladies, arguing that if the deb disgraced herself, their own reputation was on the line. Debutante presentations were not foreign to the Americans. The first debutante ball in the United States was held in 1817 in Savannah, Georgia, and the custom soon spread around the country. The character Scarlett O'Hara from the Civil War novel Gone with the Wind was a debutante. Many American heiresses did bag a noble British husband, and they and their money were incorporated into the British aristocracy. Check out my video on American dollar princesses. Debutante presentation and the social season continued to be a cornerstone of upper-class British life through World War I and the 1918 flu pandemic. So many young people died in these events that those who survived shifted their priorities. Courting rituals loosened up considerably. Young women were just beginning to attend university and have careers and lives outside of becoming a wife and mother. And they won the vote in 1918. Court presentations carried on, but many debutantes, or debs, saw it as a bore and a family obligation, rather than a highlight of their lives. Elizabeth Montagu Douglas Scott, the future Duchess of Northumberland, was crowned Deb of the Year in 1939. As part of the honor, she played long-dead Queen Charlotte and cut the giant birthday cake with a sword. Elizabeth found the whole process deeply embarrassing. Sir Ewan Forbes, a trans man, was pressured by his family to be presented as a Deb. At the time, he was undergoing early hormone treatment and beginning to grow chest hair. He found the whole ordeal deeply uncomfortable. Unity Mitford, the fourth of six sisters, found the debutante circuit deadly dull. She let her pet rat loose at dances, wore a snake as a necklace, and wrote letters to friends on paper she'd stolen from Buckingham Palace. She later defected to Germany and joined the Nazi Party. Deb Fiona McCarthy had been accepted to Oxford University, and magazines labeled her a blue stocking, a derogatory term for liberal-educated women. In the 1920s, the fashion for short haircuts made it difficult to keep the ostrich feathers in place. Hair pieces, diamond star pins, and tiaras were common solutions. Ostrich feathers were finally removed from the dress code in the 1930s. In 1939, King George VI and Queen Elizabeth sat through five sessions so that 1,000 debutantes could be paraded before them. There were concerns that the event had lost its exclusivity. Before the presentations, cars carrying Debs were lined up on the street to Buckingham Palace. The public came out to gawk at the young women, often making comments on their appearance in earshot. Magazines printed details and reviews of debutantes' looks, what they wore, and who was courting them. In 1932, the Bystander wrote of that year's class, "On the whole, they were not as pretty as last year. There was rather a lot of puppy fat." Fashion magazines gave advice on what Debs should expect and wear. One suggested that if a Deb couldn't afford to order couture gowns from the famed court dressmakers, she could get by with a wardrobe costing £223. That's about $15,000 today. Most Debs and young gentlemen were eager to get the formal court presentation and boring balls out of the way. Once their chaperones fell asleep, they could sneak out and go to nightclubs. American Ambassador Joe Kennedy and his family, including future U.S. President John F. Kennedy, participated in the 1939 London season. The Kennedy children were incredibly popular for their good looks, charm, and carefree nature. 19-year-old Kathleen "Kick" Kennedy met William Cavendish, the son of the Duke of Devonshire and descendant of Georgiana, at a Buckingham Palace garden party. The pair wed in 1944, but 4 months later, William was killed in action on the Belgian border. Kick died in a plane crash just after the war. She was 28. World War II was a death knell for the debutante ball. Most young women, aristocratic and common, went to work to support the war effort. They labored in factories and on farms side by side, and class distinction crumbled a great deal, but not entirely. The royals lost interest in sponsoring the debutante ball. Prince Philip called the event bloody daft, and Princess Margaret complained that every tart in London is getting in. In 1958, Queen Elizabeth II announced she would no longer have debutantes presented at court. The debutante tradition does carry on in several capacities. In the United States, young women from wealthy and famous families are presented each year at debutante cotillions in every major city in the U.S., especially in the South. The most expensive and prestigious is the invitation-only International Debutante Ball, held at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. Much like their British predecessor, these events are criticized for promoting classism, racism, sexism, homophobia, and transphobia. Many African-American organizations have created their own debutante cotillions, highlighting academic achievement and community service. American high school proms have their roots in debutante balls. They're seen as a more democratic rite of passage into adulthood. Australia and Ireland also have deb balls, which are something in between a cotillion and a high school prom. In the early 2000s, the original Queen Charlotte's Ball was revived by former deb Ginny Hollam Peel, Princess Katerina of Yugoslavia, and Princess Olga Andreevna Romanov serve as royal patrons. Modern debutantes are recruited from Britain's elite private schools and include the daughters of many famous and wealthy people from around the world. Their program now includes classes on business skills, networking, etiquette, and fundraising for charity. And they still curtsy to a giant birthday cake, just as young women did 240 years ago. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. I'll be putting out new episodes every Tuesday, revisiting and revamping my most popular YouTube videos, unburying some of my favorite hidden gems, and adding even more fascinating information for your listening pleasure. Want some visuals with your history? Then check out my YouTube channel, History Tea Time with Lindsay Holiday, where you can find hundreds of videos about queens of the world, royal history, women's history, and more. You can also follow History Tea Time on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other great shows like Queen's Podcast, Ancient History Fangirl, Redacted.